Thank you, Mary Frances. You're very kind. I can think of nothing I'd rather be called than a good Al-Anon. You've indulged me in every way that you could, and I'd like one more indulgence. I'd like all of you to meet my Bill. I know most of you have met him, but I want all of you to see him. My name is Arbutus O'Neill. I am powerless over alcohol. This is an admission that I must make and accept every day of my life. A life that is unmanageable without the daily practice of the principles of the Al-Anon family group. A program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety and learned that the only way they can teach the things that are good and beautiful in life is to give them away. And when they looked around to find a group of people who needed this program even more than does the alcoholic, they found us, the spouses of the spouses. The principles of this program saved my husband's life and the lives of many of my friends. The principles of this program gave me some degree of stability and make it possible for nearly 400,000 alcoholics to live useful, sober lives. I strongly recommend the principles of this program. Now, ordinarily, when I speak at conventions, I begin by thanking the committee for inviting me here. But today I have to do something a little bit different. I have to apologize to the chairman of your committee, and I might just as well get it over with. Jean called me very early last spring, I believe it was in February, and I told him I would be delighted to come here. But I reminded him that it was a long time until October. And he said, yes, I know I do this, but if you want to get good speakers, you have to invite them early. And did you tell him what I said, Jean? I said, that's right. I accepted this invitation with great humility. And I do apologize, I'm not really a smart aleck. And I've been embarrassed about this ever since I said it. And then I didn't get to hear Mary Frances in Shreveport last year. My husband went up there and I had to stay home at work and I resented it. But he brought the tape back to me and I played it and I wanted to be sure that I remembered it. So last week I played it again. And she told about all the beautiful clothes that she bought when her Jim was drinking and about these lovely outfits and I felt dowdier and dowdier. I almost called and said I won't be there because I don't have a beautiful new outfit. But I am here and I'm grateful. I'm making quite a reputation with AA committees around the country. They have learned that I don't do my best thinking in the morning. So they arranged to put me on the program in the afternoon. And for this I am grateful. It's true that I'm one of the night people. I tell my AA husband this is his fault, too. But I got this way waiting up for him when he was drinking. This isn't the truth, of course, but non-alcoholics get in the habit of blaming everything that goes wrong on the drinking. And some of us have to be in Al-Anon a long time before we really get honest. More and more of the AA convention committees are making it possible for the Al-Anons to speak at open meetings, and for this I am very, very grateful. It is in open meetings that we are able to reach the people who need us. I want this afternoon to reach those of you who are here who attend an occasional open AA meeting or a convention with your AA spouse, but who do not really know the full joy of sharing this beautiful way of life. I want to reach those of you here this afternoon who live with active alcoholics who may never stop drinking, and who do not know where to go to find the courage necessary to live with these very sick people. I want to reach those of you who do not know the fulfillment of literally putting a family back together again in the Al-Anon family group. I hope that many of you are here today, and I hope that you will soon join us. The Al-Anon family groups need you, and you need us. I am what is known as a long-termer, formerly called an old-timer. It's been my privilege to work with the families of alcoholics for many, many years, long before we had Al-Anon family groups. And I want to do two things here this afternoon. I want to comfort the disturbed, and I want to disturb the comfortable. Every time I speak at a meeting, I am again conscious of one particular thing. Every one of you are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. Our lives have been affected by one of the oldest problems known to man. Alcoholism is not new. It's as old as time. I used to think that alcoholism was a product of this generation, but this isn't true. Alcoholism is a complex disease that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about the drunk, but it leaves families homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. It's a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it, and Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one in these other generations, as far as I have been able to learn, ever was able to do very much about alcoholism. The priests and the ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady that turned otherwise honorable men and women away from everything that was good and decent. They preached to the alcoholic, they prayed over him, they forced him to sign pledges, and when these things failed, they damned his soul to hell. The men of science and other generations tried to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students, "Don't waste your time on these worthless people. They're hopeless." Since treatment failed and there was no cure, there was only one other thing they knew to do with the alcoholic. He must be punished. So they locked him up in jail. The more they drank, the longer they stayed in jail. And the longer they stayed in jail, the drunker they got when they were finally released. It became a vicious circle. They tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And we'll never know how many sick alcoholics died in the jails across our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. And society permitted this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. Neither preachment nor punishment could solve the problem of alcoholism, and there was no treatment. But there was one group of people who never quite gave up on the alcoholic. These people were the families of the alcoholic, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot cat. We bailed you out of jail. We pled with judges. We said, "John's a good man when he's sober." And society was puzzled that we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. Some people thought we were endowed with some special quality that makes us better than other people. They gave us nice shiny halos to wear. Mine was called self-righteousness. And we wore these halos quite willingly. You can find them discarded in any Al-Anon group that you like to visit. We don't wear them anymore, and I'd like to tell you they're not very comfortable. There was other people that thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. She used to say, "God looks after fools and drunkards, and that takes care of our Judas and Bill." And Mother was right. God did look after us. More recently, of course, the professionals have decided that we're masochistic, that we enjoy suffering and the suffering of other people. And these people may have been right, some of them or all of them. I think it depends on which side you're on. Society was puzzled at one other rather strange coincidence. many very brilliant, talented people were alcoholics. And this is what saved our skin. These brilliant, talented people held the attention of an indifferent society until help came along. History tells us that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old, and he wept because there was no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. The sweet singer of songs who gave the world its most beautiful folk music was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. They found Stephen Foster on the New York Bowery, sick unto death. And when he was dead, they found in his pockets exactly 38 cents. One penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair, but the love for his wife could not stop his drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could read the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a quart of gin or a fist of vodka. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room. You saw it too. You saw the bottle change the man you love or your beautiful wife into a babbling idiot, into a degenerated animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history has little to say about the families of these men and others like them, but I know the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. And I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He was also tubercular. And I know the joy that she knew when his body became well and strong again. And I know the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. Robert Louis Stevenson lived happily for many years in the South Seas. And when he died, the natives made a shrine of his burial place. If you go there today, you can read the epitaph he wrote for himself on his tomb. Under the wide and starry sky, dig a grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. And this be the verse you've graved for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill. These beautiful words express the peace and contentment that comes to the alcoholic who has come to the end of his road, and he doesn't have to run anymore. It is no longer necessary for an alcoholic to die in drunken ignorance, as did Stephen Foster. And it is no longer necessary to go to a South Sea island to find sobriety, because we are doing something about the disease of alcoholism. Clergymen now feel that alcoholics are God's children too. And they send them to AA groups for treatment. And they send their families to us so they can get well, too. American Medical Association classifies alcoholism as a treatable illness, and now we can get an alcoholic in a hospital. I don't know what your situation has been in this part of the country, but not many years ago, it was impossible to get an alcoholic in a hospital in the state of Texas. Not unless the doctor was willing to say something else was wrong with him. Now we have alcoholic wards in all of our state hospitals, and many private hospitals will treat alcoholics. County judges now send alcoholics to AA instead of sending them to jail. And we have wonderful rehabilitation programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA. National Council on Alcoholism has launched a tremendous campaign to teach the public about alcoholism. Magazines and newspapers write articles about alcoholism. And all of these things are wonderful. I'm grateful for every bit of the effort that's being made. But we're not getting the job done. Now, don't misunderstand me. I would not low rate our professional friends. I have great respect for their training and for their good intentions. I'm simply saying to you here this afternoon that they do not know all there is to know about alcoholism. But at this moment, I am looking at a room full of experts. You are the real authorities on alcoholism because you have lived it. You know the drinking pattern of the alcoholic. You know the behavior. You know about alcoholic convulsions. You've known the terrors of VTs. You know the alibi system. You know about dry drunks. There isn't very much about the disease of alcoholism that you do not know because you have lived it. And this is a job for you to do. A job for you and me. And we don't have to go at this job blindly. Our responsibility is great, but our instructions are clear. I learned this several years ago when I was invited to speak at an Al-Anon rally in Detroit, Michigan. I was excited about this meeting and a little scared, as I always am, and I wanted to do a good job. And while I was getting some material ready to present at this meeting, I read again in my husband's copy of the Big AA book, the chapter to the family afterwards. Now, I had read this chapter many times before, but on this particular occasion, there was one paragraph in this chapter that seemed to hit me right between the eyes. This paragraph has never let me rest from that day until this. This paragraph has caused me literally to travel thousands of miles to talk to people like you. It seemed to be written in italics. Now, you're not going to remember what I say here this afternoon, and it doesn't matter. But I want you to go home and read this paragraph. If your copy of the Big AA book is the same as ours, you'll find it on page 137. If your book is different than ours, read the whole chapter. It'll be good spiritual exercise. This is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, every member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. End of paragraph. Does this leave any question in your mind about what your responsibility is to the families of the alcoholic? Does this leave any doubt in your mind about how you can show your gratitude for the sobriety in your own home and for the good things that sobriety has brought to you? It doesn't leave any question in my mind, and it dispels all doubt. And I know what you see when you come to meetings like this. If we have visitors here, and I sincerely hope we do, I hope you will not feel that we exaggerate the seriousness of this problem. You see a room full of happy people, well-dressed and well-fed, but it was not always this way. Alcoholism has invaded all of our homes. Some of the alcoholics are sober, and some are not. Some of us have suffered serious financial damage as a result of alcoholism. Some of us have suffered physical abuse at the hands of the alcoholic, and all of us have suffered grave emotional damage as a result of alcoholism. We have one thing in common, the disease of alcoholism. But do not fear that your capabilities will be inadequate to this task, great as it is, because you need no special training. You simply need a compassionate heart and the willingness to share your experience, strength, and hope one with the other in love, as I did here this afternoon. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to this meeting. I didn't know much about alcoholics in those days, and I could see no constructive purpose to be served in associating ourselves with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd ever touched. They'd ruined their own lives, they'd lost their businesses, they'd lost their families, they'd ruined their health. Some of them had done terrible things and they'd been in jail. And I didn't want to associate with this kind of people. I ended up having quite enough trouble, thank you. I did go to the meeting, however, and for this I shall be forever grateful. It was an open meeting. We met in a rather large room. There was about 100 people there. And after we were seated in the meeting room, a lovely little lady that I learned later was a member of AA leaned across Marguerite. Marguerite was my friend who had taken me to the meeting. And she whispered to me. She said, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" So you see, I wasn't in such a great shape myself. To be perfectly frank with you, I was just about 2 jumps ahead of a fish. I was going to answer the lady's question. I hesitated a moment because I wanted to remember when I had a drink. But Marguerite was terribly embarrassed. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. In order to tell this story this afternoon, I must of necessity make references to alcoholics. I've already told you that my husband is an alcoholic, that his name is Bill. And now I must tell you that my father was an alcoholic, and that my youngest brother is a practicing alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. Dad was one of those people who never quite made this program, and he wanted to. He used to say to us when he'd come to Texas and stay sober for brief periods, "How do you get the want to?" And we never could answer this question. Can you answer this question? How do you get the want to? For many years after I gained the courage to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I used to close my day with one special prayer: "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Some of you know that my father died last year. He didn't die drunk. He had cancer of the esophagus. And I want to tell you how it was possible for me to tell my daddy goodbye. The O'Neills are not poor folks. We are just always broke. And last year was no exception. Two of our daughters were attending the University of Texas, and our only son had started on a new job. Everybody was spending a lot of money, and no one was making very much. And I got a telephone call from my brother who told me that Dad wanted me to come home. Now, I knew that Dad was seriously ill, but I kept hoping that maybe he had a chance. And he didn't have a chance. And I knew why Dad wanted me to come home. The last time he'd been in Texas, he'd stayed drunk. And he'd said some pretty ugly things to me and to the children. And it didn't bother us, but it bothered Dad. So I got up the next morning. It was one of those gray spring days when the sun can't quite decide to shine, threatening to rain. And you know the kind of day I'm talking about. Your hair hurts. Your skin don't fit. You can't put your shoes on. I was completely off the program. And I didn't have sense enough to turn this problem over to God, so God just had to reach out and take it. The telephone rang, and I answered it, and it was Henry Townsend from Greenville, South Carolina. And Henry said to me, "Arbutus, we want you to come to Greenville and speak at our AA convention." And the wheels started going around in my head. I figured I could make arrangements to leave my family for a weekend. Our oldest daughter was expecting her twins, and she wasn't getting along very well. So I said to Henry, "When is it?" And he said, "April 3rd. And I said, "Henry, I'll come on one condition, that I may be allowed to speak to the convention crowd and leave immediately." And I did not tell him why. And Henry said, "You can come on any condition." And that's what I did. An AA committee bought me a plane ticket to the East Coast, only a few hundred miles from where my father lived. And I was able to spend the last days of his life at his bedside. He died 30 minutes after they called me back to Texas. The minister who conducted my father's funeral could think of nothing more appropriate to use than the poem Thanatopsis. This was a poem that my father loved, and he could repeat it word for word, no matter how drunk he got. And those of you that are familiar with the works of William Cullen Bryant will remember the closing lines of this beautiful poem. "So live that when thy summons come, thou go not like a quarry slave at night scourged to his dungeon, but approach thy grave like one who wraps the draperies of his couch about him and lies down to pleasant dreams." I do not tell you these things about my father that you may weep for him. He's all right now. He doesn't have to drink anymore. I tell you these things that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love the alcoholic, I want to restore his family. I know that the alcoholic loves his family above anything on earth, even when he tears us down over and over and over again. He loves his family most. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. I was not concerned with drinking when Bill and I were married. I drank with Bill and we had fun. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States. And we got drunk in Saratoga, Kalamazoo, Chicago, St. Louis, and San Antonio. I can't remember having ever been drunk in Augusta. But we've been mighty drunk in Atlanta. We sure have. It seemed to me back then that it was extremely important for us to have fun. And I sometimes say that Bill and I had so much fun, it darn near killed us. But in 1940, two things happened to make Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. I no longer drank with Bill. Things suddenly became too serious. We had our second child the next year, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, and she didn't see her father until Sunday. When Bill came to the hospital that afternoon with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to your wives when we have new babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the hospital. He wanted to teach the Catholic nun, who was in charge of the maternity ward at the Good Samaritan Hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, the Texas stomp. And the good sister didn't want to dance. When he left the hospital that afternoon, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. This was perfectly logical. Bill was still having fun with his drinking. We had our only son the next year, and this time the trip to the delivery room was a little bit different. They needed Bill, and they couldn't find Bill. Now, had they asked me or had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that Bill was in a bar, but I didn't know which bar. I argue with my good AA friends on occasion, and they tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. I think I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. And the crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child and you hear her cry for her daddy and you can't find her daddy. This, my friends, I believe, is loneliness. Our little boy was a frail child. The doctors told us he'd never walk. Alcoholics are sensitive people. I've watched Bill stand by this child's crib, this golden-haired little boy of ours who couldn't kick, for long moments and go get drunk. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. The drinking progressed, and Bill started having personality clashes with the people that he worked for, and he changed jobs often. One of these jobs took us to Knoxville, Tennessee during the war, and days would go by when we didn't see each other. Now, we were not separated, not physically. Bill worked for Holland Furnace Company, and it was necessary for him to call on customers in the evening, and I'd hear him come in late at night. He slept in another room. And I'd hear him go out in the morning, but we didn't talk to each other. There was nothing to talk about except the drinking, and neither of us wanted to discuss that. This job that Bill had was a good job. He worked on commission, and it was not unusual for him to make $500 or $600 a month. $500 or $600 a week, some of those paychecks were. And we were evicted from a furnished house that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. And each time that I saw these eviction notices, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the faces of those who served them. Houses were hard to find in Knoxville at that time, and we had to move up into Kentucky about 70 miles away in order to find a garage apartment. I was expecting our fourth child, and when I checked in with the local hospital there, I learned that it was for the exclusive use of the coal mining employees that lived in that area, and that I was not eligible to go there to be delivered of my child. About the time that I made this wonderful discovery, they carried Bill home. Now, they'd carried him home before, but this time his leg was broken. This is the part of the story that I don't like to tell, but my husband insists on it. He says this is real good for you high-bottom drunks. So we got a cast put on the leg, and we got on a Greyhound bus to go to Cincinnati, Ohio. I was going there to get help from my mother. Peggy was 3 and Nancy was 2, and our little boy couldn't walk, and I was expecting our other baby any minute. And I went to Mother reluctantly because she couldn't stand Bill. Mother's only 12 years older than Bill, and she hated him with a passion. Since he's in her age, she thinks she hatched him. I'd like to tell you that Greyhound bus driver was most relieved when we reached Cincinnati, Ohio. My fourth child, another little girl, was born in the charity ward of the Salvation Army Hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio. And this was not the last of the eviction notices that I was to see. And I was to become familiar with welfare agencies when I was forced at last to go to a welfare agency for food for my children and treatment for my young son. And again, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. And I'd like you to know that when I came to Texas nearly 23 years ago, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my husband's drinking, and I had never heard the term illness. But I think I knew even then that Bill was compelled to drink. He drank when it was important for him to be sober. He lost his left eye and his left arm in two separate accidents as a result of drinking, and he couldn't stop. He lost his self-respect and the confidence of his friends, and he couldn't stop. He almost died as a result of drinking, and he could not stop, and I watched this happen, and I could do nothing to help him. At this point, I would like to say something directly to the alcoholics in this room. I have seen and heard AA speakers around the country stand up at podiums like this and have the unmitigated gall and the audacious arrogance to say non-alcoholics do not know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I've held an alcoholic in my arms through the long nights when he was in convulsions. I've watched the sanity leave his eyes until I didn't know which eye was made of glass. Scared to death that he wouldn't live until morning, and then scared to death that if he did live, he wouldn't have any mind left. My own father has beaten me black and blue, and he loved me dearly. I was his firstborn. He's beaten me black and blue, killing spiders that only he could see. And I've worked with alcoholic women until my hair and my skin reeked with the odor of formaldehyde, and there's nothing in the world with the nauseous odor of formaldehyde. And then go home to send my own children to school, grateful in the knowledge that but for the grace of God, somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee. I know the physical anguish that you must endure. And I know the mental torture. And I want you to know that it doesn't hold a light to this feeling of hopeless inadequacy that those who love you feel and must endure. This feeling of wanting to help and not being able to. Those of you who are parents know this feeling to some degree. It's the feeling that you have when you tend a sick child. And the child is burning up with fever, and its little body's racked with pain, and it cries, and you want to help it. With every fiber of your being, you want to make the child well again. But you can't, because the child can't tell you where it hurts, and you can't help it. The alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help them. Did you ever try to help an injured animal, a dog perhaps with a broken leg, and it bites you? This is what you did to us. We wanted to help, and you wouldn't let us. It was like you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we could see you, and we could hear you. We could hear your cries of pain, but we couldn't get through to you. You wouldn't let us. And this tears the insides out of us. This takes away our reason for living. It leaves us empty. And it makes us nothing. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she is familiar with the disease of alcoholism. And the next time that you make it inconvenient or possibly impossible for your family to go to get the help that they need in this program, will you remember what I said? Will you remember that we loved you and we tried to help you, and that not very many of you would be here if somebody hadn't loved you? And would you remember that your family is just as sick as you are? Because of this unholy compulsion, and because of the problems it created, Bill and I started what I like to call a new kind of education. In the pursuit of this education, we met many people, and we learned many things. I learned to have faith in God, to trust my fellow man, and to have confidence in my husband's sobriety. The first of these people that we met, of course, were the members of AA. And I shall never forget the first AA member that I talked to. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for the alcoholic. And I was interested and excited in the things that he had to say. And after about 2 hours, I asked him a question. I said to him, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and the children of the alcoholic?" And he couldn't answer my question. I don't think anyone had ever asked him this before. And so he said to me, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." At that moment, I could not wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was literally so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes, and this good man said to me, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I think that subconsciously that cold November evening that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of the alcoholics. And by the grace of God, this opportunity came. Because then I was to meet another group of people. This was a very special group of non-alcoholics whose lives had been most dreadfully affected by the disease of alcoholism. It was vitally necessary for these people to practice the recovery program. This was a very special group of non-alcoholics whose lives had been most dreadfully affected by the disease of alcoholism. It was vitally necessary for these people to practice the recovery program of AA in order to restore their sanity and to preserve their own stability. These people entertain the same fears as does the alcoholic. These people nourish the same resentments as does the alcoholic. These people cultivate the same self-pity and develop the same personality defects as does the alcoholic, sometimes in a much greater degree. There was only one difference. These people did not have the allergy to alcohol, and this was the most revolting development of all, because this meant that they could not find escape in a bottle. They had to take their punishment standing up cold sober, and there's not a man among you that can do it. Some of these people seem to have been born with an understanding heart. And the rest of these people seem to have acquired this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I seem to know these people and to be drawn to them. They could give me courage to face life one day at a time. They could make my life a little bit better just because they were there. And in time, these people came to be called Al-Anon. Now, I came to these people physically, mentally, and spiritually destitute. I had no faith in God. Oh, I believed there was a God, a supreme being, a creator of the universe, if you please, who changed the seasons and turned the nights into day. He hung up the stars to make it pretty far. And I thought he put people here. And then he let us go to hell backward. And I know now that I tried to pray when I was cold and scared and hungry. And I know now that he heard me when I cried, "Oh God." Because you see, I believe that God listens very carefully for the beginner's prayer and for the alcoholic's prayer, because he seems to know that we do not have the courage to speak aloud. And he knew that I didn't have the words that prayers are made of. And he knew why I didn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself. I came to these people not to get my husband sober. I came here to try to pick up the pieces of a disintegrated personality that once had been me. And I was not responsible for the things that I did, and I was not responsible for the things that I said. And my four lovely children were afraid of me, and my sober husband was ashamed of me. These children were afraid of me for a good reason. If they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, I punished them unmercifully, and I insisted on the white tablecloth. I'm sure a psychologist could figure that out, but I've never been able to. It doesn't make sense to me that you try to prove to your own children that you're an aristocrat. They were afraid to bring home their grade cards if they had a C on it because I would not tolerate failure. Failure to me was a gross human weakness, and I would not tolerate it. And I didn't want these children to be afraid of me. But they were doing quite wonderful things then in the field of mental health with group therapy, and so I came to the meetings. And I listened with tongue-in-cheek, I'm afraid, when the members spoke of prayer and meditation because I didn't believe them. But I stayed in the meetings, and they told me there were some things that I had to do. And I wasn't willing to do them. Not entirely willing to do them, because all the things that they told me were so completely foreign to my thinking. I knew that things weren't going exactly as they should, but I blamed all of these problems on the drinking. And I couldn't quite understand now that the drinking had ceased, that the problems continued. And these people told me that I'd have to work on myself. That there was nothing in the world that I could change but me. And I wouldn't want to stand up here and tell you that overnight I became a wise and wonderful woman. This isn't the truth. But gradually things did begin to change when I very mechanically at first started putting the principles of this program to work on me. Just very mechanically, starting with step one and right down through the list. Putting them to work on me. And things did begin to change. At first I noticed that our children could relax around me. They're so relaxed now that they have no qualms about thanking me. And when I could laugh at myself, I knew I was getting well. And I began to make friends. First right in my own little group. And then they made me delegate to World Service from the state of Texas, and I made friends all over the state, and this was wonderful. And I got to go to New York, and I met Bill Wilson. I'll never be able to explain to anyone quite how I feel about this great and wonderful man, Bill Wilson. And I met his lovely little wife, Lois. This wise little Yankee lady who knew everything there was to know about me before I opened my mouth. And who loved me because of these things. I made friends all over the world. And some of you told me that you liked me. And then I could belong to the human race. I've never belonged anywhere in my life. I grew up in construction camps around the country, and I never belonged anywhere. And the first thing that Dad would do when we'd move in one of these places would be to build a fence around our place. Now, there was a reason for this fence, and it was not to keep the Martin children in, it was to keep the other people out. You see, we didn't need people. I never belonged in a community because we didn't live there long enough. I never belonged to a school because I didn't go to one more than one semester until I got in high school. I never belonged to a church. You don't go to church when you don't believe in God. And now I belong to the most wonderful group of people in the world. And these people have given me everything on earth that I want to keep. This program gave me more than I asked for. It gave me more than I expected. It gave me more than I deserved. It even gave me more than I'd ever dreamed of. It gave me the ability to raise four well-adjusted children. Our children are all grown now, and we have five grandchildren. It gave me back the man I married. And that's really all of us, all any of us want. To have the person we married walk in our front door again. And this program gave this to me. It gave me back the man I love, this tall Texan, that I always loved, sometimes in spite of him, and sometimes in spite of myself. This is my story. A story of darkest despair turned into one of thanksgiving and hope. And I sometimes forget to tell people what happened to my little boy. He weighed into the Navy at 189 pounds, this frail little boy who was not supposed to walk. He's home again now. He works for a small electronics company in Austin, Texas. He has a lovely home and a beautiful wife. And I'm not ashamed to tell you that sometimes when he runs across a parking lot or jumps the fence that I get a lump in my throat. This program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And we're the only people who can carry this message. A message of hope. Hope will never die, not as long as men live. It will burn low at times, and it's up to us to keep that flame alive for those who follow us. And there isn't anybody in the world who can do this quite as effectively as those here in this room this afternoon, and in meetings all over the country, meetings from the rock-bound coast of Maine to the sunny shores of California. Meetings of alcoholics and of their families with this message. Right here in this town and in my town, there are drunken men and women who will not live to see the light of another day, who will never know they're alcoholics if we fail to carry this message. In this town and in my town, there are women who won't have the courage to face life with another day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their home unless we carry this message. In this town and in my town, they're frightened children. Children who are afraid for their daddy to come home at night, who dread for night to come. You heard some of them this morning. This is Saturday, and Saturday night were the worst of all, remember? These children will grow up with deformed personalities unless we carry this message. If we fail to reach these people, God have mercy on them. And God have mercy on us. Thank you.